Hello, we are the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. I'm Jimmy, and I'm one of the deplorables that voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza, and I'm very willing to marry for a European passport. Seriously, anyone. I'll learn foreign and everything. I'll even do Finnish, and I'm great with parents, and I'm a really considerate lover. Just please, somebody give me a lifeline.
Well, maybe you'll get lucky and Scotland will leave the UK and join the EU. You can marry a nice Scotsman.
Oh no, let's not have another conversation about how that's going to screw with my identity.
It might be worth the trade-off, though. You know, you'd get your European identity back, but the British thing would be...
It might be, but I would be rejected by all Scots as a plastic Scot. I already get enough grief when I wear my kilt. And they're like, you don't sound like one of us. Do you not even know what a Cayley is? Like, I didn't know what a Cayley was until about, 6 months ago.
Yeah, you're like one of those phony American Irishmen who thinks they're Irish because they have an Irish surname and they've actually never been to Ireland. And
100%. Everyone hates them. But it's definitely not my fault because I was raised as such and only have recently realised how ignorant I am about my Scottish heritage. Mm. Anyway, we meet weekly to talk about politics, social issues and current events. How are you doing, Jimmy?
Yeah, I'm a bit ropey, to be honest with you. We are recording this on a Thursday evening, so the week has sort of already taken it out on me. This is the world's tiniest violin story. But yeah, I'm feeling pretty bad.
I feel so sorry for you,
Jimmy. Thanks for asking.
With you and your job.
Yeah, it's tough, man. It's tough. How you've just moved to Oxford, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm a junior dean now. I now am the primary point of welfare for all students in this college that I'm at.
Yeah, we were actually having a conversation at my office about the risk of employees spouting off about their company on social media, so perhaps we should say no more about your new employment.
It's lovely. I have nothing to say that is bad about it.
I suppose you would say that, though.
Yeah, I have also only had 2 days, though, so...
Yeah, stay tuned.
It's great. It's great so far. So this week, we, as always, have three topics. Jimmy, which one do you want to do first?
Oh, I think we should start with the Brexit extremism, or Brextremism, as I'm going to call it. YouGov came out with this poll. We all trust polls, especially after the last couple of years.
Yeah, and we love nothing more than a Brexit poll.
So this poll basically suggests that... Leave voters would be willing to sustain significant damage in order to pull Britain out of the EU. 60% said yes they would, and only 20% said they would not. And this is kind of the headline statistic that went around social media. 39% said that they would be willing to one of their family members to lose a job in order for Britain to leave the EU, and a similar amount said no. Your view, roughly, I suppose we're going to go into some detail later, but what are you thinking about this?
So there is a very lovely ranty article by John Elledge on the New Statesman, which annoyingly is increasingly becoming the paper that most aligns itself with my points of view in its way of screaming into the void. And this article is titled, "This YouGov Research on Brexit Proves Baby Boomers Hate Their Own Children." So that's how I basically feel about it.
Okay, so we'll go more in depth on that poll later. What's the second topic that we're going to be following up on?
So another poll. Great. This is what happens when you continue to do political-based content throughout the summer when everybody is on holiday.
Content.
Everything becomes a story about a poll that's been released or scientific research that's been released.
We'll try and crowbar an animal story in at some point.
Oh, yeah, we'll do something.
Keep in with the rest of the British press.
Yeah, exactly. So the Adam Smith Institute, which are like a pro-neoliberal...
It's a free market think tank, is how I describe them.
Sure, but they are like...
they are crazy neoliberals, Jazza.
They are all...
they do want to sell off your organs for consumption.
Pretty much. Yeah. So they have done some objectively quite bad number crunching. like literally, I've looked into their methodology. So they say that about 50% of UK academics are like significantly left wing. Wait, what was
it? It's 8 in 10. 8 in 10 is what it says on my Telegraph article here.
I'm trying to look at the actual raw data. Yeah, something like that.
Okay,
So lots of academics vote left wing, apparently, and they're saying that this encourages groupthink, that this is something that we need to tackle in our academic institutions because right wing people aren't equally represented, and this should be treated in the same way of representation of women and people of color and other kind of minority backgrounds.
Don't scoff, you know. This is a serious argument from a serious think tank. So, and obviously, they've done the numbers real good. They've added them up and like subtracted and divided. It's been great.
We'll go into the issues with the numbers later. So actually, I think that this is broadly quite an interesting story because there obviously is. Anybody who's been to an academic institution ever knows that lefties love to talk about Marxism in ivory towers. Mm. But I think that there is probably a little bit more nuance in this story than just...
Are you saying the headlines do not fully convey the substance of the story?
Quite possibly. Who knows? More on that story later.
More on that later. And for our last topic, we are going to be talking about human embryos, which I know you're all going to look forward to. This is like genetic engineering, isn't it, Jazza?
Yeah, kind of. This has widely been reported that there's some US scientists in Oregon who have been able to genetically modify human embryos so that they no longer have genetic traits passed down. I believe the one that they used in this one was something to do with a I can't find it right now, but it was like a cancer or like a lung defect or something like that. And all of the...
It says it was a heart disorder on the BBC article.
Like a major organ. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So there was a major organ defect that they managed to kind of genetically modify out of these human embryos. And everybody now thinks that we're going to have designer babies. Mm. And it's probably not going to be the case because genetics is really complicated. And I've tried to understand it this afternoon by trying to teach myself genetics. And it is very hard. But it does sound...
it takes longer than an afternoon to learn about it.
Apparently, you know, I was ready to apply for my PhD.
Jeez.
But this is like quite an interesting first step. But also, I'm sure that we're going to pontificate about the possibility of designer babies.
Well, I think your angle on it is actually more interesting than the designer babies angle, which a lot of people have discussed, which is often...
Are you about to explain my point of view, Jimmy?
Kind of. I'm gonna roughly outline it because I think you sort of undersold the topic slightly in that you get this thing among deaf people where they're resistant to the idea of having their hearing fixed, as it were. They probably would be resistant to the idea of it even being termed as being fixed. Mm-hmm. That being deaf has become so much a part of how they see themselves that they don't want it to be altered in that sense. And I think there's the interesting argument you put to me was that some of the things that are defects in a sense, things like dyslexia or I put forward the example of short sight, can be a part of somebody. And is it actually a good idea that we're eliminating all of these things?
Yeah. So the reason that I think about this quite a lot is because I am dyslexic and I do have short sight. And I have a load of other like genetic things that would, in an ideal world, in a sort of dystopian future, would probably be bred out of me. I have hay fever, I'm a gay, and if you were able to find the gene, then that would probably be bred out of you as well.
I like that you just compared having hay fever to being gay.
I mean, in many ways, are they not very similar?
I mean, almost in no ways. Almost not in a single way.
But I'm very cognizant, and especially with dyslexia, we're actually, when you're dyslexic and you get the proper help for it, you're encouraged to believe and to understand that you view the world in a very, and you process the world in a very different way that actually, in many senses, like, is good for humanity as a whole, because we're able to approach problems in a different way. And
I'm going to stop you there, because we are going to argue it fully later on. But I thought we've outlined the topic.
You are so rude.
I'm teasing the audience. I'm, you know, we put out this intro thing. We'll play some music and then we'll be back.
Such a cock tease.
This is the occasional reminder that we now have a Patreon account set up where you can throw us a few quid if you're enjoying what we do. Just go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. We have a couple of reward schemes set up, so if you donate more money, you will be able to get nicer things, including at the top end, an appearance on the podcast. But as I said, details are on the Patreon website, patreon.com/rightdishonourable. So, Jazza, are you worried about the sudden influx of Brextremism, as I'm going to call it? Because I think we haven't had enough terrible portmanteaus in the past couple of years.
What, like Brexit?
Yep, like Brexit.
I think there should be a rule where you can't portmanteau a portmanteau.
It's like a portmanteau squared. I think we can make it happen.
No, we're not doing that. well, I actually was... I am concerned about the amount of people that are willing to forgo the economic futures of their children in order to... Jesus, I mean. Think of the children. I am concerned about that, but they have already fucked us over by voting to leave the European Union. And so this doesn't surprise me at all. I am curious, though, in terms of like this just being another poll. This is an opinion poll. It's all hypothetical. And this is something that also gets kind of parroted by a lot of the talking heads on the Sunday morning politics shows, where they suggest that people will change their mind about Brexit when the consequences actually become real. At the moment, it is just being hypothesized at the moment that there is the possibility of their loved ones losing their jobs. And that is probably going to happen. I feel like even you, Jimmy, would admit that there is going to be at least an initial dip to the UK economy, which will mean a loss of some UK jobs.
I mean, I'm not... an economist, it will surprise you to know.
Our economic analysis is usually so sound.
It's usually so on point. There's obviously a possibility, some would even say the inevitability, that growth will be damaged as a result of Brexit, and some people have argued that there'll be a recession. And at some point down the line, that does translate into job losses, either in the form of jobs that would have otherwise been created or jobs that already existed and have been lost. Yeah, it's a possibility. But the point I'd kind of make, and I made it on Twitter and it seemed to confuse you at the time, is that if I said to you, look, we've got an offer on the table to become the 51st US state, and it will boost our economy by 2-3%, or you know, whatever. It say that it would go up, it will create jobs, more wealth in the economy, etc. I don't think most people who voted Remain in the referendum would see that as a worthwhile trade-off. And I'm not directly comparing, you know, that hypothetical scenario with how we left the EU. I'm saying that my point is that political concerns sometimes override economic ones.
Yeah, and people vote against their economic interests all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, such as Brexit. And...
or the Labour Party.
Or even the Labour Party.
Zing.
But I did have a bit of an issue with your hypothetical scenario, because it's very difficult to like to compare those two scenarios when only one of them has ever been on the table. There isn't a split of kind of like, I still believe that an awful lot of the Brexit vote on either side ended up being about like Britishness and identity, and about the UK being resurgent, and you have very sensible views on the whole thing, which you made very clear on the podcast that you did with Lena Norms on I'm Not Being Funny But, which was very good, Jimmy.
I feel there's a but coming here at some point.
Yeah. but there is a Venn diagram of Europeanness and Britishness that was the main point of conflict when, in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, and it just really and it ended up really reinforcing feelings rather than facts, and that I think is something that really did kind of echo through the whole debate and continues up until this point. I do think
what do you mean by Venn diagram? I'm not entirely sure what you're trying to get at with
well
that
there's
image.
Europeanness and Britishness, in the same way that there is Scottishness and Britishness, and there is kind of like there's two extremes of the two of people who identify as completely one and completely the other, and then there's the Venn diagram in the middle of people who are kind of like, well, I'm not sure which one I am. It's kind of a little bit of both.
Yes.
And the problem is there are so many more people who identify on the extreme end of the British side of things, and so were therefore it was very difficult for them to identify with anything, identify with their MEP, with all of the stuff that the European Union does, this collective identity. And it's not just a problem in Britain, it's a problem across the whole of the Union.
There was actually a Eurobarometer poll, which I know we keep quoting polls in this podcast, but a Eurobarometer poll across the entirety of the EU, all 28 member states, which asked people, do you feel politically European? I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that was the gist of the question. Or do you feel like a European citizen, I think was the way they phrased it. And I think the average was 68% across the whole of the EU, which I thought was quite high. In Britain, it was lower, although it was still something like 56%. It was still a majority, which I thought was interesting. I assume people interpreted that question in a kind of emotional sense as opposed to the kind of legal sense.
Yeah, I think that citizen does, it's a word that does evoke strong emotions.
Well, I'd actually say the opposite almost, is that I think citizen's a legal term. So I'm not 100% sure about the phrasing of the question, but, you know, obviously it is true that a lot of people feel affinity across the EU with the idea of a European state, or, you know, in whatever you classify the EU as, which is the EU is quite difficult to classify anyway. I actually find, sort of in relation to that, that there's a second part to this YouGov poll. So
about the age.
No, I'm not looking at that bit. So 60% of people who voted Leave said that they'd be willing to take economic damage to bring Britain out of the EU. I thought this was very interesting. I didn't see this so much on Twitter, but 34% of Remain voters said that they think that economic damage would be, significant economic damage would be a price worth paying if Britain stayed in the EU, which I think speaks to a strength of feeling about identification with the EU and EU citizenship that we didn't really hear an awful lot about during the referendum debate.
Yeah. And I'm one of the weirdos that would fall into that category, because as has been very clearly documented across all of our episodes, I just feel really European. I feel like I'm destroying my identity. How do you think, as I do, that these people's like, I'm not sure that people's actual opinions are expressed
good?
In the well that, but also I'm not sure that their opinions are very well expressed in this poll, because I think they're being asked, and there's almost a hard-headedness to prove that, yeah, I do want to leave the European Union, and it doesn't matter if my kids can't study abroad, and it doesn't matter if my kids can't get a job, my grandkids can't get a job. But do you think that there is the possibility that when/if those consequences start happening, opinions could change? Because at the moment it's all hypothetical.
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible that things could change. But, you know, it's just kind of just a basic fact of human decision-making, that when you're asked a very abstract question, you can think about it in an abstract way. you'll behave differently when you're met with the actual consequences. You know, it's like asking somebody if they he's trying to lose weight, if they, you know, think they want to have a donut when they get home, and they'll say, oh no, I'm trying to lose weight, that'd be a bad idea. But when they actually get home and they're tired, they eat the donut. Don't know why I use that particular example, but you see what I mean. Like, it's there's a distinction between intellectual decision making and the more guttural kind.
There is a very distinct difference between age as well. So people who were 65 and over, 71% of them who voted to leave the European Union were in the section of people who said that they didn't mind if there was going to be wider economic damage. 50% of them said that they didn't mind if members of their family if members of their family lost their jobs. And then people who were 18 to 24, only 46% said that they were okay if the wider UK economy was damaged, and 25% was if members of their family were okay if members of their family lost their jobs. So there's a very significant drop of about 25 points on both questions between 18 to 24 year olds and 65s and overs.
Yeah. So the fact is that people who you'd assume have more money, more economic security, have more of an appetite for economic damage. That's the gist of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because frankly, also, those are the people that are going to be less economically affected by a recession, for example, because they already have the assets. I found this quite interesting, especially when it was framed with the whole baby boomers hate their own children. And in this article from the New Statesman, from John Ellidge, he does go on to say that boomers were the people who got free university, were able to buy houses, were able to get assets, and all of that kind of stuff. Do you think that this shows a huge kind of generational gap that is kind of stronger than the left-right divide in the UK?
As we were saying last episode, the left-right divide is only useful or only potent in as much as people continue to believe in it, and it continues to be the organising principle of the Labour Party and the Tories.
Yeah. And we will talk about that more when we talk about the Adam Smith Institute.
I mean, it's an interesting contrast to the idea that Brexit was a cry for help from an economically deprived group of people, because obviously young people voted to remain, and as we've said, they're in a more precarious economic position, and older people voted to leave, generally speaking. So I don't know if anyone's managed to square those two things. You know, the overriding narrative that Brexit was about the economic crisis, and then, you know, the fact that really the generational voting patterns and generational appetite for economic damage is totally counter to that. But actually, these polls, I don't think these sort of questions have ever really been asked, unless you... You could kind of say that because the so-called Project Fear, the Remain campaign, focused so much on the economy, the question of the EU referendum in itself ended up becoming, you know, even given that everyone says it's going to cause economic damage, do you still want to leave the EU? But, you know, it depends whether or not people believed it, and I'm not really sure they did.
There is often a touted kind of like truth in the world of politics that when you're younger, you vote more liberal or left-wing, and when you're older, you vote more right-wing. I find it difficult to see how that's going to happen if things like access to housing, and if things like massive amounts of personal debt continue to be something that ends up being specific to the younger generation, because at the moment it really is. And I think that there is going to perhaps be a bit of a permanent generational shift because so many of the decisions made by the boomer generation have fallen on the shoulders of young people.
Yeah, I mean, what you say is true, and I think that shift will but you know, in a crude way, what will happen as older people start dying off and the demographics, you know, the people mm-hmm. who can't afford to buy a house become a higher proportion of the voting of the electorate, then inevitably the political parties will have to address those concerns. It's, you know, it's just electoral maths at the end of the day.
One final question on this, Jimmy. You, as our resident Brexiteer, how would you have answered this survey? Do you...
I think I've already answered it in the podcast many, many times. I voted assuming that there would be some economic damage, and I still voted,
Leave. What if, like, your family members lost their jobs, Jimmy?
This is a terrible question to ask me personally, because two of my immediate family are unemployed and the other one's a teacher.
So it's the summer now, so he's also basically unemployed.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I probably would. Because I think self-government is more important than money at the end of the day. But then I'm saying that coming from a privileged position. So, if I was at the bottom of the food chain, as it were, I might not give the same answer.
You, Jimmy? Privilege? Never.
Well, then let me flip the question back at you then. If you knew that us remaining in the EU, however unlikely you think this scenario is, would cause economic damage, potentially even cause one of your loved ones to lose a job, would you still vote to remain in the EU?
I don't care. Fuck them.
So none of us has claimed the moral high ground in this question.
No, not at all. but then I'm surprised by you. Not surprised. Like I am aware of what you're like.
After almost 90 episodes, you've finally twigged.
Yeah. But like I said, my membership of the European Union and my identity as a European citizen goes beyond like economics and how sensible it is. Like, I've always felt an attachment to the institution, and I understand that that makes me a very, very strange sample of the British public.
Well, seemingly not, because a third of people lot of people in that Eurobarometer poll kind of said the same thing. And then what was the stat?
No, but I'm like an extremist, Jimmy.
So you're a Remextremist? Remonstremist?
Sure. Why did you have to... We've started with a portmanteau and we ended with a portmanteau.
I think that works. Shall we move on to this, scoundrel Adam Smith research?
So can I just say, the title of this briefing paper... is called Lacademia, Why Do Academics Learn Lean Left?
Yeah, that is a shit pun. I'm not having it.
When you have a pun in an quote-unquote academic paper, be wary, as a general rule.
Yeah, I mean, this is a white paper rather than an academic paper, though, isn't it? A little bit.
Yes, but it's just a briefing paper that tries to come across as like vaguely academic because they've done some number crunching. So yeah. That around 50% of although 50% of the general public supports right wing or conservative parties, only 12% of academics do so. This should be said that this was. They've taken this information from a self-selecting survey, which means that people opted in to be able to take the survey, which generally is not seen as a very good way of representing a population very well.
Did they not do any weighting at all then?
So some weighting would have been done, but still a self-selecting survey is not like YouGov. Would shy away from that kind of stuff.
I mean, that aside,
this isn't their research. They've taken the research from somebody else.
I see. Who have they taken the research from?
The research is from an academic called John Morgan for the Times Higher Education website.
Okay. But irrespective of those methodology problems, do you find it implausible that 8 in 10... university lectures could be classified as left-wing?
No, I think that it's probably quite accurate.
So after all those quibbles with the research, we're like, yeah, pretty much.
No, but it is. So one of the claims that they make is that this has been the number of left-wing people who are teaching in academia has increased hugely since like the 1960s and 70s and 80s. But they use different data points in order to try and prove that, and that's why I have kind of an issue with this, because they've come to conclusions that I don't think are necessarily very good. What they have actually done quite like their explanation for this is the idea that people who are more quote-unquote left-wing are more likely to be open to experiences and care less about the economic benefits of going into a job or going into like a lifestyle like academia. And so they're going to be more likely to populate these circles.
Well, people make similar arguments about business and the fact that right-wing people are more likely to go after money because of inherent conservative values. So I mean, it kind of makes sense to me. What do you make of the idea, which I think is it's kind of the most interesting part of this this summary that I read, that there's a case to be made for political, ideological diversity in universities.
So this is... I am all for diversity, and actually I'd quite like to see some more of it. I do have a gripe with the idea that a lecturer and a teacher who is left-wing is not able to present a... different worldview to the one that they have, and I certainly have been taught different worldviews by people who have taught me in the past, and they didn't necessarily believe them.
Like, I don't think anyone would really dispute that, but I think the wider point is that, and this is similar to the arguments made for, say, diversity on boards, and it's less that it's impossible.
Oh God, I am making the same excuse as you do all the time.
What's the excuse?
Oh, you're like, why can't a white guy represent a black woman?
I mean, that's a fair argument. The argument in return to that is that even though it is true that one person can represent somebody else's case, the tendency of a homogenous group is going to be towards representing the views that they hold generally. So it might be true that, you know, a largely left-wing university can portray right-wing views, but ultimately the way they present those views is going to be skewed towards a left-wing point of view.
Yes, and I don't know why I'm taking this side of the argument so strongly, because actually I quite agree that there should be more intellectual diversity.
I have to say that there's something a bit sinister about the idea of universities vetting their professors for political beliefs.
So should they vet them, or should? So I think that there's ways of doing this by, like, whenever somebody becomes an academic and starts a residency at a university or an educational institution, they do end up getting vetted by the people, by their employers, in terms of what they've already published, in terms of their teaching styles and all those kinds of things. And perhaps this is something that universities should be more cognizant of when they're giving out jobs. They should be like, oh, we've got a lot of people who are super into Marxism. Maybe we should get this academic in who's really into Randian objectivism.
Yeah, possibly, but I think you'd struggle with the Randian objectivism, to be honest with you. I sort of wonder as well if it isn't, it's probably the case that in certain departments in certain universities they skew one way or the other. So you might have a right-wing department in a largely left-wing university and that sort of thing. The trouble is that if you're trying to fill up a sociology department, it's going to be very, very difficult to get a lot of right-wing academics, just because of the nature of the subject and the sort of people who are attracted to studying stuff like gender studies. No offense. And I'm sure the same.
I don't study gender studies.
Not you. Just, you know, people who do. There's certain inherent natures to different subjects that I think attract a certain type of mind, let's say. I don't know, you're right that, I mean, there's already a lot of, I'd say businesses are kind of being subtly prodded, and sometimes not so subtly prodded, by people to essentially enact positive discrimination in certain scenarios, albeit very subtly. So, if a business is hiring for a new position and there's two candidates who are about the same in terms of merit for the job, if one of them happens to be white and the other happens to be black, there is a bit of subtle prodding going on to make them go for the black guy. I'm not making that up. That was actually in a report I was reading today about diversity in business. So there's a little bit of that going on, and I'm sure you could, if you wanted to, do a similar thing for academics in university, but I'm not really sure. It as I said, there's something a bit sadistic about political vetting that I'm not entirely on board with.
I do actually think also that there is this damages the right a lot, because I think that the left does benefit, although it doesn't. It isn't doing particularly. Is it doing well at the moment? I guess Corbyn did okay, didn't
Depends
he?
Depends who you define as the left, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that like more right-wing kind of ideologies do suffer from there not being as strong a base in academia, because it's very difficult for them to reinterpret their core ideologies into the modern setting. And I think that in general, conservatism in this country has kind of struggled to resonate very strongly in like the new economy, where workers' rights are broadly being seen as being abused. And they've actually ended up having to steal a lot of stuff from the center and from the left, like concepts like the living wage and all of that kind of stuff, which have come out of like left-wing thinking hubs. And I think that the right does struggle to kind of innovate with a lack of kind of this background in academia that it has.
I'm not entirely sure I agree. I mean, the point you raised around the living wage and some of the ideas that have had to be adopted by the right from the left, that is all true, and I think it's true for the strategic reasons you kind of implied. I think if you look back at Margaret Thatcher's rise to power and the creation of, you know, dirty neoliberalism that the Adam Smith Institute stands for, there are a couple of think tanks. I think it was chiefly the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which acted as the term of art is usually outriders, as in people who would float these ideas into the political sphere and eventually build the intellectual foundations in order to ease a politician's policies into practice ultimately. So I think that the right does well in terms of think tanks, and arguably think tanks, probably because they're more actively engaged in politics, are if not more important, they're just as important as universities, I would say, in you know, creating the general intellectual climate. I mean, we've talked to, for instance, about the sacrosanct is it the Institute for Fiscal Studies that I'm thinking of, the one that reviews the budget every single year?
Oh yes,
yeah, sorry, the Margaret Thatcher's think tank is I think it's the IES or something. They all have like the same name, it's impossible.
Yeah, they're all three letter acronyms.
But the other thing is that conservatism is not given to thinking to coming up with like one grand theory of how the world works. It's just something that's inherent to, I wouldn't even call it conservatism as an ideology, because it's more of a tendency than an ideology. It's just an instinct, a way of actually broadly speaking thinking about things in a more pragmatic way and approaching issues as they come up, rather than coming up with something big like Marxism or something like that. You do have exceptions, like you mentioned kind of Ayn Rand and her almost anarchistic kind of ideology. I was almost going to use the word theology there, which is probably slightly more appropriate. But
I mean, you can scoff at Ayn Rand as you want, but she's she is incredibly influential in a lot of conservative thinking, especially in the United States.
Yeah, and, definitely.
In the English-speaking world. For anybody who doesn't know, she wrote Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead.
Yeah.
Are her two most influential kind of novels. And basically, she has the philosophy that don't care about anybody else, because then you're just being selfish.
Hmm. But how is being selfish? Because I've always understood it as you kind of have to nobody else owes you anything. You just have to kind of make your own way in the world, and you know the state doesn't owe you welfare or anything like that.
She also hates altruism to its core. She's like, if you're being altruistic, then you're being evil.
Okay, I'm going to need to know more about that for you, but we don't want to get too sidetracked.
yeah, we have sidetracked a little bit.
On this kind of broader point, I think it's just a fact about the way the British state and various institutions in Britain works that the left and the right are dominant in different spheres. So, for instance, in broadcasting, as in television media, radio media, I think it's fairly evenly balanced, but in certain cultural respects, I'd say the left has an edge over the right. Fleet Street tends towards, as in newspapers, tend towards the right wing. Universities tend to be...
At least an editorial, right?
Well, yeah, just in terms of what news is presented, the news agenda and that sort of thing. There are the only major kind of vaguely intellectual newspaper, like left-wing newspaper, is The Guardian, and on the other side you have arguably the FT, The Economist, The Telegraph, The Times. And when you look at the tabloids, you only have The Mirror, who's really on the left, and then you have The Express and The Star and whatever. Business tends towards the right, as this report's kind of proved. Academia tends towards the left. So, I mean, aside from having like a crazy amount of state intervention to sort this all out, and I'm not even sure how it'd work out in practice, I think it's sort of something you just have to accept that.
So I feel like the conclusions of this are actually very neoliberal at the end, where they're like, yeah, you should probably think about this a little bit more. Rather than demanding quotas, which would not be very Adam Smith in tissue. And I would actually probably tend to agree, despite the fact that I did attempt to rip into this paper because it annoys me so much because it's not very good.
It's almost as if think tanks aren't proper academic bodies and essentially just opinion hawkers who, you know, drape themselves in the clothes of academics to make themselves seem more legitimate.
But they pretend to be, and that really annoys me as I learn about academia.
I mean, I don't have like a crazy amount of respect for academia for all sorts of reasons, but I do think it's a bit fucking weird when you get these corporations issuing white papers that look as though they're academic reports, and it's all a little bit sketchy, to be honest with you.
Well, speaking of academia, shall we talk about genetics and super babies?
Oh, what a segue.
I know! Isn't that good? So what do you kind of understand as to what's happened in this lab in Oregon, Jimmy?
So effectively they were trying to find a way to prevent this heart disease by altering the DNA of embryos so that instead of having to treat the disease after somebody's developed into a full-blown human or baby, I suppose, you treat it kind of at its source, and therefore it stops being a problem. So I mean, this has kind of been the I think arguably the main driver of this kind of research. You know, we always talk about designer babies and that sort of thing, but one of them, I think the main priority, or the priority before that, is actually just to solve some very basic genetic problems so that people like babies who get very unlucky have a chance to live a healthy life.
And there's people who find out that they are like people who have sickle cell disease, for example. If they find out that both the mother and the father end up having the recessive gene, then their child is almost definitely going to end up getting it. And so that complicates things to them. And something like this, kind of like genetic engineering, would allow people like that to be able to have children as well. There's talk of eliminating stuff like dwarfism, stuff that is like very clearly genetic that ends up like that are seen as genetic defects. So I'm gonna try my very best to describe a little bit of the science.
Oh my god. First we tried to discuss economics, and now you're trying to make us discuss science. This can only go downhill.
I did A-level biology and physical education, so I am 100% equipped to do this. But basically, they would they injected an egg with a sperm and this extra artificial thing that was meant to replace a bit that was going to be cut out of the DNA, and then cut out of the sperm's DNA. So the sperm's DNA had the defect. The egg was fine. So what was meant to happen was that the artificial bit was meant to replace the thing in the sperm. But actually what ended up happening was that the egg bit, same bit of the DNA, ended up replacing the bit in the sperm. So it wasn't really artificial. It was more kind of like spliced and diced rather than something artificial being put in. So this actually means that stuff like being able to genetically modify a baby are way, way off. Mm. But the possibilities are certainly, certainly there. Like, the ball has started rolling.
So as I was kind of saying at the start of the podcast, your kind of newer angle on this is the idea that by eliminating things that we consider to be defects, I mean, you mentioned just now dwarfism, mm-hmm. We might actually end up losing something, and I'm fairly sure that there's going to be people who are affected by various conditions that don't really want this kind of meddling even potentially for their children. I mean, since you've got dyslexia, would your if say you're having a kid and the doctor says to you, look, we can do this very simple procedure in which we'll eliminate the necessary genetics that create dyslexia, your kid will be born without dyslexia, whereas otherwise they would have been without the intervention.
Mm-hmm. I will say I don't think that this is purely hypothetical, because I don't think dyslexia is a gene.
Well, yeah, I'm definitely mangling a lot of the science just assume dyslexia for the sake of the philosophical argument. Then is that something you go for? Would you want to prevent your child having something like dyslexia?
No, not at all.
Ah, okay. What's your reasoning for that?
Because of the way that dyslexia works anyway, I actually feel quite empowered by my dyslexia, because my brain works in ways that normal brains don't work, and it's meant that I'm really, really good at certain things, worse at stuff like spelling and maths.
So what are the advantages of having dyslexia then?
There's loads of stuff. So your oral processing is a lot better. You tend to think, quote unquote, more laterally. Mm. An awful lot of people who start successful businesses. The rate of dyslexia is a lot higher in that demographic than the general population. They tend, an awful lot of successful people are dyslexic if they're given the right resources. Mm. But that's the thing, we require a little bit of extra help in order to tap into the potential there. But I'm really proud of being dyslexic.
But it sounds as though your case there is that there's actually a trade-off going on, where you actually definitely lose something. But whereas if I think... to take another example, we're both short-sighted, and I don't particularly feel there's any advantage to being short-sighted. It's mostly just an inconvenience. I don't know if you take a different view on this.
Yeah, so I've also thought about this, and I get quite poetic and wanky when I think about this, because I've had the option of having laser eye surgery in the past.
Yeah.
And I've chosen not to, because I think that I get something out of being vulnerable without having to have some kind of eye corrective wear. And I think that it's something that I have grown from in terms of being aware of my very fragile humanity and my lack of ability to I'd be out of the gene pool, because I wouldn't be able to hunt and gather. Mm. I'd have to be a shaman or something if we were cavemen.
See, I don't feel that way. Like, laser eye surgery is something I might get, I suppose, at some point. But just if hypothetically my parents could have intervened and I wouldn't have to wear glasses, I definitely would choose that. I don't really feel there's an upside. But
I think that you do get something out of it. There is something about having to Like, I feel like there are upsides, but they're very, very nuanced. And I feel like using the like eyesight example is probably a lot closer to the kind of genetic disorders that are going to possibly be eradicated here. But
yeah, I accept that you feel there's an upside. I just can't say I see it the same way. So yeah. I'd ask you, are there any conditions that you actually you can't imagine that there's any upside to? I mean, this particular heart condition that the scientists were trying to treat, presumably you feel that whatever upside there might potentially be to that, and I can't see one, it's massively negated by the risk of sudden heart attack.
Yeah, so I think that this is why the conversations that we need to have are quite important, because this is clearly going to be happening further down the road. Perhaps not stuff like dyslexia or like the shape of your baby's nose or whatever. But what you are going to be able to do is hopefully eradicate those diseases that are basically just mean that you're going to die sooner. I think it's different for stuff like dwarfism, and you mentioned deaf people yeah. who are born blind. I think that those are very different things, because those are things that have like cultures around them, and like it provides an extra strand to humanity. I also feel funny about Downs as well being something that gets controlled for, but stuff like heart defects and things like that, I think that is justifiable.
Yeah, I think there's the heart defects sort of probably predisposition to certain forms of cancer as well. I imagine mm-hmm. might be able to be mitigated against at some point. So there's a whole lot of uncontroversial things I think that you would want to eliminate. I mean, the deaf and the blind thing is quite interesting, because I can certainly understand if somebody's lived with a particular disability for their entire life, they do consider it quite essential to themselves. It's a little bit different, the idea that they would want to confer that onto their children. And I think there's an interesting ethical argument there from the doctor's point of view as well. The doctor, so say somebody somebody is having a kid, maybe they're deaf, maybe they're not, and the doctor detects through an embryonic scan that the child is highly likely to be born deaf, and they can fix it with an intervention at that point, for instance, or you know, maybe this happens slightly earlier in the process, before the in vitro fertilization, but the argument is roughly the same. Does the doctor then have a responsibility to intervene for what would widely be regarded as the better health outcome, i.e. having working yeah, hearing this versus being deaf?
Yeah, this is where it gets so, like, mind-fucky. The thing is, I don't think that I don't think that the doctors who are going to be making those decisions are going to be the people who are like your general practitioner who cares for you during the pregnancy. But I understand your hypothetical. I think that like that's why we need to have these conversations and decide where those lines are.
Well, ultimately, it's not really the parent's choice, is it? Because we respect the idea that a parent has a guardianship role over a child's rights. But, I mean, we even had this case in the last couple of weeks, the Charlie Gard case, where ultimately the court decided that the wishes of the parents, and these were medical wishes, it was a desire to try out an experimental treatment on a very ill child, they ultimately were superseded by the state's view on things and the court system's view on things. And I find it very, very likely that if a deaf couple, for instance, decided they wanted to have a child, and this treatment was available where they could, the doctors could, or a treatment was available where you could very easily go in and alter the genetics so that the child would be born with proper hearing. If the parents wanted the child to be born deaf, I have a very strong feeling, just the way that previous court cases goes, that the state would say, look, if you're going to have this child, we're going to insist that their hearing is fixed.
I don't know about that. I understand like the broader implications of it, but I don't know about that specific example, because very often because deaf people function in a completely different world to hearing people. And so I kind of understand the desire to keep your kid within that world, and I think that that might supersede the whole better health outcome for the child.
I doubt it. I mean, I see the point that you're making, but I would find it... I mean, if the case I just described was going on now, I would be absolutely staggered if the court decided that essentially the whims of the parents in this particular instance, you know, outrode the general consensual view of what counts as good health. Because there's lots of alternative examples you could think of.
But that's the thing. I think there's an awful lot of people who live with... stuff like dwarfism, stuff like deafness and blindness from genetic differences, and they would argue that they aren't that they are like part of their humanity, and that's what I find. That's the argument that I find really compelling in this. That it is just another form of human experience, and yes, it is a more complicated form of human experience, but who are we to decide that only the genetically perfect have a right to exist in this world? Because well, then you end up just in a dystopian future like Gattaca.
Not necessarily, because, you know, I think there's... being deprived of one of your senses, I think, is fairly... I can certainly see the argument you're putting forward. There's definitely a case to be made there, but being deprived of one of your senses, or, you know, being deprived of one of your limbs, for instance, they're fairly analogous in many ways. I would be in favor of insisting that if such treatment was available, that it be applied. I'm sure there will be people that that take the opposite view, but yeah, I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see where such a debate goes.
We'll look forward to debating this on the Right Dishonourable in the year 2040.
30 years time.
Yeah.
If we're still going. Should we wrap this up, or do you have anything further
no,
to say?
No, I'm fine. Thank you so much for listening. Please leave us a review on iTunes, because it really helps us, and we think we're doing a good job, and it would be nice if you supported us in that way. Also, share it with a friend, that one other person who you have those geeky political conversations with. Share this podcast with them.
Indeed, and definitely go check out the podcast I did with Lena, which you can find if you Google I'm Not Funny But...
I'm not
being funny, but yeah, don't
also,
don't
I'm not
Google
funny,
what
but.
I said. Yeah, or just, you know, go look
where
at
Jimmy talks about being a Brexit voter,
a deplorable Brexit voter.
It was really lovely listening to it and understanding that you haven't really taken on board any of the stuff I've said to you over the past couple of years.
I've got to say, man, like, we've talked about Brexit
too much.
It must be like in the region of 30 hours, and that's just stuff that we've recorded. I think it probably isn't that much. We've talked about it a lot more off air as well, and I'm just absolutely baffled that you'd want to listen to another hour of me talking about
it. No, I just listened to it and I was like, but I've already told you that this is wrong. It was kind of like, it was like whenever I feel a little bit of like self-hate, I go and read the Daily Mail for a little bit. That's how that episode of I'm Not Being Funny But was. Not that it wasn't good, it was brilliant, but it was incredibly infuriating because you were the subject matter.
I mean, what is also infuriating is that Lena has informed me that she is already getting better numbers for her podcast than we are. So,
oh yeah, no, 100%.
That's deeply, deeply distressing in many ways.
Yeah, no, but she's like a talented young lady.
That's true. We have no talents. On that bombshell.
Follow us on Twitter at Right Dishonour. You can find me at Jazza John and Jimmy at JDE Nichols. Show us publicly that you love us. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.